to this meeting of Senate Resources Committee. It is 3:30 p.m. in Butcherich Room 205. Today is Monday, February 10th. Members present today are Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, Senator Giesel, Senator Rivak, Senator Kawasaki, and Senator Keel. We have a full group. I'm Senator Michicki. If I didn't say that, let the record reflect we have a quorum. Today we have two bills on the agenda. We have Senate Bill 171, Industrial Hemp Program Manufacturing, and Senate Bill 161, Geothermal Resources. We're going to start with the Senate Bill 171, sponsored by Senator Hughes. Senator Hughes is unavailable today due to a family emergency, so her staff, Buddy Witt, is here to present. If you want to join us, Mr. Witt. We are ready when you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Hughes. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, Senator apologizes for not being able to be here in person. And she's entrusted this to me, so I will do my best. Thank you again for hearing Senate Bill 171 today. A little bit of background on where this bill came from, a little bit of history, recent history. Most of the members of this committee actually heard the predecessor to this bill, Senate Bill 6, which was introduced in the 30th legislature by Senator Hughes. The work on creating an industrial hemp program in the state of Alaska actually began before that, when Senator Johnny Ellis worked on this issue extensively. In the 29th legislature, then Representative Hughes was contacted by a constituent and asked to help with getting Senator Ellis's bill across the finish line in that legislature, but it just did not happen, and the time ran out. So Senator Hughes took the lead on legislation to create an industrial hemp pilot program in the 30th legislature. That was in 2016. We were able to get and establish a more feasible way forward on industrial hemp because of the 2014 Farm Bill, which was signed into law on February 7, 2014, and included Section 7606, which allowed states to establish an industrial hemp pilot program. The USDA gave statements of principles on industrial hemp in August of 2016, and that outlined our path forward on the program that we then put into law with Senate Bill 6. That was signed into law in April 2018. But as things go, when we were taking direction from the federal government, things quickly changed. With the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill, and that was signed into law on December 20th, 2018, this new legislation removed industrial hemp from the Schedule I controlled substances. And then the USDA released their final rule of regulations on the 2018 U.S. Farm Bill on October 29th, 2019, which gave us some additional information on what changes we needed to make to our current statutes in order to meet federal compliance. The passage of the 2018 Farm Bill requires us now to present Senate Bill 171 to make just a few changes. It removes the industrial hemp pilot program statute and instead adds the authority to permit the manufacturing of hemp-related products and registration and the renewal process for participation in an industrial hemp program. Puts it directly under the Department of Natural Resources here in the state. It adds one little piece about that a registrant could not have been convicted of a felony, drug-related felony, within the last 10 years. And it says that the department must develop a program that is compliant with federal law and submit those regulations to the USDA for approval in order to have an industrial hemp program. There are also two cleanup provisions in the bill that I will cover when I'm going through the sectional analysis that have nothing to do with the federal requirements, but simply go back and look at some incongruent language that was in SB 6 and tries to fix it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go through a sectional and then open up to questions from the committee.
Any questions for Mr. Witt before we review a sectional? Seeing none.
Thank you. Section 1 starts on page 1, line 3, and goes through page 3, line 8. There are two subsections added. They're on page at the end of this section. Authorizing the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources to include the manufacturing of products made from industrial hemp, as well as registration and renewal procedures in the regulations for industrial hemp program. Because later in the bill we're going to be doing away with the pilot program altogether, it was important that these two subsections be added. In section 2, and this is it adds language that a registrant for industrial hemp is not eligible to participate in the program if they've been convicted of a felony involving a controlled substance within the last 10 years. And again, this is in order to meet with the requirements of the 2018 Farm Bill. There is also a requirement that, and it's referenced there as well, that there be a grandfathering in provision. And this was found not in the 2018 Farm Bill, but actually in the federal regulations. The reference for that, and I can happy to follow up by email, is 7 CFR 990.6E1, if you'd like to look at that. Section 3 of the bill adds that the department shall develop an industrial hemp pilot program that complies with the federal requirements and then submit that plan to the United States Department of Agriculture for approval. And then finally, in Section 4, we have a couple of repealers that I'll go into a little bit more in detail. And these are the two fixes, or one of them is the fix that I referred to before. So the first repeal is 0305077. That was the portion of the law that sets up an industrial hemp pilot program. There's no need for a pilot program anymore. It'll simply be a program within the Department of Natural Resources that is regulated by the department. And then the second repealer is AS0305079. Now, this is the piece of law that basically says if a producer of industrial hemp tests between 0.3 and 1.0 THC, that they're automatically hit with a violation, that they're automatically guilty of a violation. This is incongruent with other parts of the law because in AS0305076B4 and D4, we already have provisions in place that the department can use in order to regulate and manage these items. In AS03079, any registrant growing industry hemp is guilty of a violation. However, in those other provisions, it basically says that the department would give them the ability to try to bring that percentage back down below 0.3 if it tests above. So on one hand, in the law, we're saying, well, the department will give you a little bit of grace and allow you to fix it if you're acting in good faith. But on the other hand, we're going to automatically hit you with a violation. The department pointed out that it was incongruent, didn't really fly. So they are asking that be repealed and that they're able to manage those who are acting in good faith. There is already a part of law that says if someone is growing at 1.0 or higher, then the stop sale order would be submitted, and we would fix that. And I believe that was actually done in Senator Coghill's committee when he was the chair of Judiciary back in the 30th legislature. So we kind of already put pieces in place to protect against bad actors and to give away provide a way for good actors to correct a problem within their crop. And I believe that will pretty much sum it up. I would say also that after the bill was drafted, we found one other piece kind of associated with that same part. I want to point it out to you. We are requesting a friendly amendment to this bill to change AS0305010. I'll read the section to you. It's 0305010C. As the law currently reads, it says the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall issue a stop order to any person who is found to be producing a plant product with THC over 0.3%, regardless of whether the person is registered. And we are requesting that that shall be changed to may. And the reason is, it's incongruent with the other provisions of the bill that is allowing a little bit of grace, a little bit of leniency to good actors. The rest of that section would stay the same, simply a shall to a may. Other than that, I believe that the director, the division director, Mr. Shady, Rob Carpenter, the state agronomist, and Joanne Wilson of the Department of Law are all available online to help answer any questions that the committee may have.
Just before we move on, can you repeat where the change occurs, the page and line, please, for the 0305010C?
That's not, thank you, through the chair. This is Buddy Witt again, Senator Hughes' office. That is actually the reference to law. It's not a reference to the bill. So in the law right now, again, that is in Title 3. Let me find the...
Oh, that I misunderstood your comment, which was what threw me off. So I appreciate that. That is not included in this bill because it's not yet changed. So,
yes, sir, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
So that would fall under Section 1 of this bill probably if it was to fall in. But the question that I have for Mr. Witt is the May, I understand there's one place where they want a fix-it order, but you still should have the stop sale requirement, shouldn't you? Because that product itself would be not usable. So help me understand how that would work, because I think the stop sale was based on that, on the product itself, not on the not on the seller. So help me understand, there's one where we're putting a stop sale on and another where we're trying to have a redo and replace. So just help me with the product transaction as well as the producer transaction.
Mr. Witt, if you'd rather hand that off to someone from the department, I would understand, but if you have an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I will actually defer to Mr. Rob Carter, who can tell a little bit more about what a stop sale entails. Maybe that would help us shed some light on why we're choosing this path or requesting that path.
Okay, we'll wait till we have Mr. Carter on.
Fine. That's fine with me, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Witt? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Witt, on the criminal conviction barrier to participating in this industry, I guess maybe two questions. And the first would be if you could help me understand who the applicant is. If this is a small family farm and there's really just a couple folks involved, I get that. But as this industry begins to grow, you're going to have LLCs, you're going to have maybe corporations. A better understanding of who the applicant is who would be subject to this background or this look back, that's question one. And then question two, and maybe it's foolish for me to look for sense because it's in the Farm Bill, but I'm trying to find the public safety need for a 10-year look back for some people and a 2-year look back for others who are in the biz. Can you help me understand either of those two?
As to your Senator Keel, through the chair, as to your first question, I was given an answer to that from the Department of Law, and she is online who can put that on the record, and we'd much better equipped to answer that than I would. That would be Ms. Wilson if she's available.
I am chair, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. I was going to wait till we brought others up, but if you can answer that question, that would be helpful.
I will, to the best of my ability. So through the chair, 7 U.S.C. 1639P sets out the minimum requirements that a state plan must have to be acceptable by the federal government. In its language, the section says, in general, except as provided in Clause 2, which is the if you're already grandfathered in, any person convicted of a felony related to a controlled substance under state or federal law before on or after December 20th, 2018 shall be ineligible during the 10-year period following the date of conviction. A person for purposes of that section, in the case of cooperative associations, and I would assume active family members, each member of that association that has the ability to benefit from the association would be subject to that bar.
Senator Keel?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take a look, and hemp is not marijuana, so the fewer barriers we can have here, I think, the better. Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, if I have a follow-up, if you can please put yourself on the record when you answer this as well. Would that count employees or just those that are a member of the association, essentially the ownership of the association?
Mr. Chair, again, Joan Wilson with the Department of Law. My reading is it includes people who benefit financially from the association in an ownership status. I think employee would be quite a stretch. But I'm happy to look further into the legislative history for the farm bill to see if that's accurate.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Witt? Senator Bishop?
I have a question. When the Department of Ag is up.
Okay. If that's it for Mr. Witt, we'll move on to the others. I believe all invited or all here on the phone today. So let's start with Mr. Shady, Director, Division of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So this is Dave Shady. I'm the Director of the Division of Agriculture. We are definitely, as a division and a department, in support of this legislation. As has been said, we are trying to take a pilot program and make it a permanent program. As we have done our bill analysis, we have some recommended changes. Those changes are to give the department a little more leeway as we move forward. The way the bill is written now, we are required to meet the requirements of the plan established by the USDA. All states have some serious concerns about their current regulatory status. Things like we would not be allowed to allow the conditioning from 1% down to 0.3%. We have a few things in our law that don't technically meet that. So we have some recommended changes that we'd like to work with the committee on that would allow the department a little more leeway so we can continue with the current program we have, where we have been able to structure our program to protect the farmer from changes due to genetics or the environment. So with that, happy to answer any questions, and if they're technical, I'll let Mr. Carter or Ms. Wilson answer as well.
Thank you, Mr. Shady. I assume you'll be providing the committee with a letter on your suggested changes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have done a bill analysis, and I will send that in a letter.
Thank you, Mr. Shady. Questions for Mr. Shady? Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shady is Senator Bishop. Hey, can you just give me just a brief thumbnail sketch of how this farming of hemp happens? I mean, what I'm asking you is, do you go out there and do you plow the ground under it, or do you use a disc, or do you use a no-till drill, or how does the seed come? And because you just alluded to some changes that you're wanting to work with the committee on, because as we get down to this stop sale exceeding these levels of 0.3 to 1%, you know, who's to say that your neighbor's not planting over there and there's some wind and you get some cross-pollinization, and now, you know what I'm saying, I see where you're trying to go to err on the side of safety. So if you could, and how do you plant it and how do you harvest it?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, this is Dave Shady. I'll let Rob follow up with my brief explanation with a little more detail. So industrial hemp has many, many different varieties, many uses. So you can do traditional farming, disking, you can do no-till. A lot of it will be done in greenhouses. So as we've set up this program, because there are so many different ways that you can use this product, so many different varieties, we have put isolation distances. We have done a number of things to try to manage those. So it is, you know, if you're growing for fiber, it's a variety that grows tall and, you know, a lot of mass. If you're growing for the buds, it might be in a greenhouse. So it's not a simple answer. There are hundreds of varieties and there's different purposes. So what we've had to do is develop a program that kind of morphs depending on what the different variety, the different type of use of that plant's going to be.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the division on the fiscal note we saw. It looks like $750,000 in fees from farmers ramps up in year one and then stays flat level, doesn't grow. And I just wondered if we could get a short briefer on how much we're collecting in fees now, how much those fees are likely to go up with passage of the bill, how many farmers do we have, and how many do we expect?
Senator Keel, through the chair, this is Dave Shady again. So part of our problem is we have not collected any fees because we are just now finalizing our pilot program regulations. We expect to have a handful of farmers. That is not where the serious amount of funds is going to be. What we have is we've identified approximately 20 manufacturers and between 700 and 1,000 retailers who are working in this industry. And so we have designed this program with regulations in three components. One, you're registering as a grower. Two, you're registering as a manufacturer. And third, you're going to register as a retailer. Now, you can be one or you can be all three. But as part of that is the grower has to grow. The fees are fairly small, but then the testing fees can be somewhat significant. We suspect that in the first year, we'll have a couple hundred thousand of dollars in money moving through on fees, for example, as we do the testing. So as we stand up this program, we're going to register between 600 and 1,000 entities, and that's going to take a number of resources. So we, you know, we expect with our registrations in the first couple of months to be in the $500,000 range, and then if the program continues to grow, then we'll have a little leeway to hire on more people. If it doesn't, then we just won't hire it on because this is all receipt-based funding.
Senator Keel?
So it sounds like my focus on the farming is myopic, and I really ought to be focused on that permit manufacturing of products language in Section 1. Is that where the cash is, it sounds like?
Senator Keel, through the chair, this is Dave Shady again. The farming is, you know, relatively, as far as the fee and the supervision, relatively easy. Manufacturing, of course, is going to be a lot more intense where each of those manufacturers are going to have to get their product manufacturing system approved, and then of course they're going to also have to be working with the Department of Environmental Conservation if it's a food product, and then of course in the retail market. So the system is designed to track this product from the grower through the manufacturer to the retail sales. Part of the concern is a lot of these cannabinoid products can have things in them that we don't want. So we're concerned about heavy metals. We're concerned about pesticides. And to make sure that zero THC in a product really is zero THC. So we're definitely going to have a lot of focus on manufacturing, but then we now have throughout the state a serious amount of product that's already there that we've got to go make sure it's not synthetic, to make sure it's safe. And so it is really going to be a challenging startup to this program. Does that answer your question?
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does. I will go back through the bill for the retail piece of it. I hadn't noticed that in my first read, so thank you.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you. This could be for Dave or Rob. So Section 5, Section 3, line 9, which is the sub 5. My question is, we're trying to comply with the federal rules, but we want flexibility with the federal rules. So help me understand how we're going to manage that if we modify this language in Section 3, and we still have to fit the U.S. code. So help me understand that. You're looking for that flexibility, I understand. But the way I understand it, we had to have the penalties in here in order to comply. And so help me understand how much flexibility you think you'll have if we have to answer to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, Senator Coghill, through the chair, this is Dave Shady again. So you have hit the nail on the head when it comes to the dilemma we have. What the USDA did was give us an interim final rule. By doing that, they set a one-year expiration of our pilot program. All 50 states plus the four territories have written a letter to the USDA with about 15 points of problems that we have. I don't think we're going to get around the 10-year because that's a statutory requirement that, you know, on the criminal conviction. I think that all states are pushing for the final rule that gives us a little more leeway on the 1% to the 3% for the amount of time it takes to do the testing. In Alaska, with our logistics, we have been very clear with the USDA that we're going to need some exceptions to these rules, and we know that, you know, I believe that it's a matter of time we'll be able to work these out. But if I have a statute that says that I absolutely have to follow the federal guidelines, then it's a little more difficult for us to negotiate and work our way through with this.
Other questions for Mr. Shady? Mr. Shady, I just had one, and that was more on the fiscal note, which this isn't the Finance Committee, but so what happens if you stand up these positions and participants are slow to enter the game? What then covers, pays the bills of the department until you have an adequate number of, you know, growers, manufacturers, and retail participants?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Shady here again. So we have in our current budget two positions which are for the first part of this program general funded so that we can stand up the program, and then we have receipts. So I can assure the committee that I will not be hiring people until we've received the money, and we will build this program over time. So according to the statute of Senate Bill 6, as it was developed, is industry is to support this. So one of the things that we've done is take quite a bit of time to figure out and, you know, do a projection, and then we will slowly move it forward as we have the money come in. So it's always been one of my concerns when you have a program running on receipts that you make sure you have your receipts. It's just been the dilemma of stepping up a program without the receipts in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Shady. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry to ask this question, but it was brought to our attention that the part that's not in this bill is the requirement under 010C to put a stop sale on those products that exceed. And my question was, how do you deal with a product, and then how do you deal with the producer if you put a may in the stop order? Does that help you direct the product? You know, help me understand. I think our understanding at the outset was we were going to give some flexibility to the producer but not to the product. So help me understand how that works.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, this is Dave Shady. I'll go first, and then if Rob wants to add in, he can. So first, let's remember, you cannot sell any product until it is tested and approved below 0.3. So there's an automatic, you are not allowed to even take that product out of the field unless we test it and approve it or give you written approval to move that out of the field. So without the stop order, there's no sales. We control that from the get-go. The stop order is more when it's 1%. Now that's marijuana. It is out of our program and move forward. The may shall to may is I literally was required to write a notice of violation and give them a $500 fine, even if we were realizing that this was a unintended error and trying to be fixed. The reason why I don't want it completely deleted is if you have a repeat offender and the division decides that we probably need to go ahead and give them an NOV because they've become a bad operator, we want the ability to do that. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no other questions, Mr. Carter, can you please put yourself on the record? I have you as a yes for testimony.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, this is Rob Carter with the Division of Agriculture, and always here to answer questions if any, but I think the director has done that. Thank you and appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, any remaining questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Department of Ag. So help me understand this. I'm a little, so is it most of this stuff going to be grown in hoop houses? We're not, we don't have anybody going to go out and do 1,000 acres and have a combine come through and harvest this. Help me understand this, because I get back to this stop order, and I'm thinking, if you got a 100-acre field or a 200-acre field, how do you go out and test that? And I'm not trying to prohibit the process here. I just got to get a better understanding of where do we think the market is headed.
Mr. Shady or Mr. Carter?
Go ahead, Rob.
Through the chair, this is Rob Carter with the Division of Agriculture. Senator, yes, you are correct. There will be individuals producing on large acreage if they choose to participate in the program. Across the nation, we have seen exponential growth in fields, in field production for biomass, for fiber, or for green shop manure. In all sense, we expect those applicants in some larger agricultural producing regions around the state to grow on large scale traditional agriculture, a field disc, a field prepped, a field planted with a grain drill, and then either mowed and sickled or combined, depending on the variety of choice that they've grown and the intended use. A notice of violation or a stop sale would be offered, again, as the director said, if the sample was taken by the division or a representative of the division, if that product, that raw industrial hemp tested above 0.3 and below 1%, they then, in our current regulations, proposed regulations, would have an option to recondition that lot, blend it with another lot, but that lot could not be further processed or moved from the farm or the drying facility that that farm owns. So as the director stated, if an individual produces multiple years, multiple crops, indoor or outdoor, large scale or small scale, the opportunity for the division to issue a stop sale and a notice of violation or a destruction order of that crop then could be offered at the discretion without putting the farmer in a pinch. A lot of investments made for a short growing in the state of Alaska. And if we can find the opportunity or give the opportunity for a large-scale production to be reconditioned to get the overall lot of industrial hemp down below 0.3%, it could then be introduced into the market and the farmer could generate revenue.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Do we have any other questions for the department folks online at this time? Seeing none, I'm going to open public testimony. I do not see anyone online. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 171? Seeing no one, we're going to leave public testimony open for future meetings on this bill. And I want to thank Senator Hughes and Mr. Witt for bringing that forward today. We will be holding this bill and setting it aside. So Our next, the next item on our calendar, Senate Bill 161. Take a brief at ease while Ms. Ogan approaches the bench, if you will. Okay, we are back on. Now, of course, hearing Senate Bill 161, Geothermal Resources. And I'd like to welcome Ms. Ogan, Special Assistant to the Commissioner here, if you can put yourself on the record and begin presenting the bill online. We have Tom Stokes, Director, Division of Oil and Gas. Steve Masterson, Director of Oil and Gas, and then online for questions, Kevin Frank, Petroleum Geologist, and Jeremy Price from the AOGCC. Ms. Ogan.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Laura Ogan. I'm the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm joined today by my colleagues that you mentioned, Steve Masterman, Director of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, Tom Stokes, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Kevin Frank, Petroleum Geologist with the Division of Oil and Gas. SB 161 seeks to attract attention to Alaska's geothermal exploration program. This bill will align with the state's existing oil and gas exploration license program. It will diversify the state's energy portfolio. It also increases the potential for affordable, renewable energy to both rural communities and remote resource extraction projects. So with that, I'd like to hand over the presentation to Steve Masterman. With your permission, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Ogan. And I'd also like to welcome Senator Reinbold to the room. Thank you, sir. Mr. Masterman.
Good afternoon, everybody. Chairman Michicki and members of the Natural Resources Committee. Good afternoon from sunny Fairbanks, where it's 3 below. For the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. I'm going to offer a short analysis of the bill before you, Senate Bill 161, which is titled An Act Relating to Geothermal Resources, Relating to the Definition of Geothermal Resources, and providing for an effective date. I'll provide a brief review of the bill's sections and what they do, and then review the fiscal notes, and along with my colleagues, be available to answer questions from the committee. Geothermal resources offer the potential for sustainable, affordable, local, and renewable power generation. Governor Dunleavy's administration is supportive of enhancing geothermal energy development in Alaska. And this bill is a progressive step in that direction. It removes obstacles for exploration and development of Alaska's geothermal resources in a number of ways. The bill provides for 5-year exploration licenses instead of the current 2-year permits, with one additional year, to allow more time to meet the challenges of bringing remote exploration projects into production. The bill changes the statutory terminology from permits to lease to more closely align the geothermal program with the state's dominant model of petroleum leasing. The bill allows conversion of geothermal exploration licenses to production leases upon mutual state lessee approval of a work plan instead of upon production of commercial quantities, to provide the state more flexibility in incubating a new resource industry. The bill nearly doubles the maximum size of geothermal lease holdings to 100,000 acres to accommodate the expansive size of geothermal resource systems. This will attract greater interest in geothermal resources because developers will have a greater opportunity to explore the appropriate area to delineate geothermal systems. The bill eliminates statutory reference to surface owners' preferential rights to purchase subsurface geothermal exploration rights to eliminate uncertainty among geothermal explorers and investors. And finally, the bill updates and refines the definition of a geothermal resource and provides an exclusion for domestic use of geothermal energy. With enactment of this bill, our state will continue to responsibly manage our natural resources in a manner to provide maximum benefits to our citizens through development of needed energy sources. So on a section basis, Section 1 relates to refining the responsibilities between the Division of Oil and Gas and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee. Section 2 through Section 4 relate to changing from permits to leases. Section 5 increases the allowable acreage an entity can hold to 100,000 acres. Section 6 amends the duration of geothermal leases and allows licenses to be converted to leases. Section 7 adds new clauses that allows creation of unit agreements similar to those that the Division of Oil and Gas currently utilizes to manage oil and gas development. Section 8 refines the definition of a geothermal resource. Section 9 clarifies that DNR manages leasing and licensing of geothermal resources. Section 10 exempts domestic use of geothermal energy from leasing requirements. Section 11 updates the definition of geothermal resources, and sections 12 through 16 are conforming changes and provide for effective dates. So that's a brief sectional analysis. There are three fiscal notes associated with a piece of legislation. Those from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee and Division of Oil and Gas are zero fiscal notes. And the third fiscal note from the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys is not a zero fiscal note. This would restart the geothermal program within DGGS that was terminated 5 years ago now, I believe. And this program would synthesize and provide data on Alaska's geothermal resources to support Division of Oil and Gas leasing of geothermal resources and to attract and assist companies wishing to develop our resources. It would, this position would monitor developments in geothermal technology, where those developments are changing rapidly, so the technology for geothermal energy production is evolving quite quickly. And it would also seek to attract federal funding to support investigations to develop our state's geothermal resources. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to see if the committee has any questions. And with me to answer questions, as Laura Ogan mentioned, are Tom Stokes, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Kevin Frank, who is head of the Resource Evaluation Section in the Division of Oil and Gas, and Jeremy Price, a commissioner with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee, so, and then myself, obviously. So we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Any questions from the committee? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple of questions. Mr. Masterman, you talked about removing the preference or the right of first, not first refusal, but the I guess preferential right of a surface owner to the geothermal resources. And I saw the deleted language in the bill. It talks a couple places about notice. So if this language passes as proposed, what notice does somebody get when there's a proposal to lease the geothermal rights under their land?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Keel. And I perhaps should have expanded on who is going to respond to these questions. So as a state geologist, I am going to handle questions regarding geothermal resources around the state and the definition of geothermal resources. And Tom Stokes and Kevin Frank from the Division of Oil and Gas are going to handle questions regarding the exploration licensing and leasing, and I believe this would fall under their purview. And Jeremy Price will be handling questions in regard to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee. So with that, I would like to hand it over to Director Stokes to address the question.
Director Stokes.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. For the record, Tom Stokes, Oil and Gas. We would do this similar to what we do with other oil leases. We'd have a public notice that would go out to the public. There's a mailing list that we have. We identify and identify what the sale, potential sale would be, and then seek public comment.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I assume the mailing list includes all the, must include all the surface owners then?
Yes, it would. The affected surface owners, yes.
Thank you.
I have a question myself, if there are none in the queue right now. Senator Keel, did you have another question?
Different topics.
Yeah, my question was, actually, I just don't know a lot about geothermal resources, but when you talk about royalty in Section 7, line 28 through 30, that the commissioner may not reduce royalty on a geothermal lease issued under this section in connection with a unit agreement. How are royalties paid on geothermal resources? Is that on a BTU basis?
Through the chair, this is Tom Stokes, Director of Oil and Gas. The geothermal royalty rates are 1.75%, currently what's in the regulation of gross revenue.
Okay. Thank you. That's interesting. So if someone has a lease and they essentially prove up on that lease, gross revenue means that if they if the geothermal operation is not profitable, there's not a royalty. Is that correct?
We'll be on gross revenue. Excuse me, through the chair, Senator Michicki. The rate is based on gross, not on net. So it'll be on gross revenue.
So the 1.75% is a calculation that's in the expenses of the company, whoever is producing. It's a number that's always there, whether or not they're profitable or even losing money. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. When in that section it says except as provided in F and J, is that where prior to production? Can you explain what is meant by that sentence?
Senator Michicki, initially when the license is applied for, the rate that would be charged to the company would be a per-acre rental cost. So there would be no royalty rates paid until once it has been commercially viable, and at that point then would change from a per-acre cost to a royalty rental.
And then, thank you. In J, it seems to allow the commissioner to also adjust royalty requirements. Is that, well, is that post-production?
Let's look in here for your reference here, Senator Michicki.
Page 4, lines 3 through 5 is sort of the nuts and bolts of my question.
Sorry. Yeah, so I think for the term of the lease, so the initial lease is established at a 20-year window, 20-year time frame. I think that's referring to the subsequent approval, subsequent renewals.
Okay. Okay, Senator Keel, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then maybe a question just going back to the surface owners, and it seems that prior in the status quo law before the bill, there's a little bit of a divide, looks like, in our statutes about little guys and industrial interests, right? Folks who want to use some of the geothermal under land they own. It looks like they don't have the minimum lease acreage. and that all seems to be deleted. So I mean, I just sort of have this thought about, you know, folks with a hot spring under the cabin or next door to it. Are they going to need to lease now 40 acres minimum to tap into that water and heat the cabin in the winter? Or is there still some division between the little guys and an industrial operation?
Yes, Senator Teal, through the chair, Tom Stokes. There's we're referring to commercial operations, so somebody that has it as an individual owner does not need a license to utilize geothermal resources on their personal property.
Sure. And just a follow-up, that will that continue if somebody does lease the geothermal resources under their property?
Through the chair, that would be only if they turn it into a commercial operation would that change.
So, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out kind of how that works. There are some communities around the state where there are some small geothermal, at least as far as I know, small geothermal resources. Folks are using them. If there were an interest in generating significant geothermal, the folks using them now would either have to compete with the commercial interest at a lease sale or bring in heating oil. How do we envision those potential conflicts working out going forward?
Yeah, I think there's probably details we'd have to work, Senator Keel. Again, I think the purpose or the intent is for the commercial viability, not for local usage.
Mr. Stokes, just I have to admit that is a very good question, and perhaps you can think about that a little bit and provide the committee with your vision of how that would work. I know there are instances where there are Alaskans that have used local resources for generations. I'd be interested in that answer, but without putting you on the spot right now, we'll be hearing this bill again, and perhaps you can bring that forward at a future date.
Thank you, Chairman Chickie. We will do so. Thank
you. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question's for whoever at DNR wants to take a stab at it, but under Section 2A, so the commissioner may, under regulations adopted by the commissioner, grant prospecting licenses and leases to a qualified person to explore for, develop, or use geothermal resources. So with that being said, so can you give me an idea what you might be thinking about in those regulations? Because I've been on a drill rig on a geo site, and are you going to require the same line of permitting to etc. You know, you got drilling fluids, you got drilling mud, you got cement, you got, can you explain that?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I guess I would equate it similar to what we do with oil and gas. We would look for, try to understand their operations, what they would have to apply for a license, and in that we would understand what their level of operations are. So initially, I think that would be similar to what we do now, that we'd be reviewing their plans and approving them. And then would address any particular hazards or associated drilling that would need to be addressed.
Okay.
Did I answer your question?
Kinda.
Senator Bishop.
I'm fine.
If I can understand your question better, this seems to say that a prospecting license or lease is not required for exploration. Is that correct, Mr. Stokes?
Senator, you know, that would not be correct. You would have to have a license for the exploration, as long as it met for a commercial entity.
But today, as long as it's intended for domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use, and the ground temperature is not more than 30 degrees Celsius, it does not require a license for exploration or development.
Senator Chick, this is Tom Stokes again. Yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Could the department provide us at the next hearing with a map of the state and the potential geothermal energy areas that you're aware of, and include the nearby population centers that might be using the energy sources?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, this is Steve Massaman. Director of DDGS, we would be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Also, would you say that there's a fairly good probability that there is domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use all over the state that you may not be knowledgeable about, or is that, is there a reason why they would register with you at some point in their production process?
Senator Michicki, this is Steve Mastman again. I think one of the things that we're cognizant of here, if I can get the word out right, is that the evolving technology with regard to using geothermal energy. And so for home use, most of the systems that are used are obviously smaller. They're ground source heat pumps where you're taking the heat out of basically the near surface environment. And as that technology evolves and becomes more efficient, I think that those are going to become more widespread. And so what the department is trying to do is segregate that sort of use away from the heavier industrialized use where you might be generating power on for a community scale operation or a large industrial facility. And so there is the likelihood that as technology evolves and improves that the personal or home heating type of application will become more widespread across our state. Obviously, the warmer parts of the state are more likely to see greater expansion of that, and less so in places that are colder.
Yeah, thank you for that. The reason I'm asking that question is when Senator Giesel asked for what you know about resources, I was wondering if it was worth asking the question about current smaller scale usage, because that ties back to Senator Keel's question about whether or not we need to consider something in this bill to protect smaller scale users, either current or future potential in this bill, if that quantity is unlikely to affect a commercial entity.
Yes, you are the chair, Senator Michicki, so I guess I'll respond directly to that. It's an interesting point. I appreciate the question earlier about the reference to surface owners' preferential rights and the issue with subsurface development of resources. There's a number of ways that other states have addressed the issue of safeguarding or segregating home use of geothermal energy from industrial uses, and most places that there are industrial uses of geothermal energy, there is obviously a hot spring system or a fumarole system or a local volcanic field nearby that provides the large-scale heat source for commercial operation. And there's only a couple of places in the state where those things you might consider would overlap with personal property. Manly Hot Springs would be an obvious one of those, and perhaps Circle Hot Springs would be another. So I can understand the point that is being made about surface ownership and subsurface use of the geothermal resource, but most people in a private sense are generally not going to tangle with a really high temperature or high pressure geothermal system just because of the extra costs that are involved in dealing with such high temperatures and high pressures. So most residential type uses will be shallow and on the low temperature side of the temperature spectrum, and most industrial applications will obviously be looking for the high temperature, high pressure, high volume geothermal systems that most homeowners are not going to want to tangle with. So there are some natural separations of the kinds of things that people will be involved with. Hopefully that helps answer the question.
It helps, and we did state that we wouldn't put you on the spot, so it's something for you to think about perhaps for a follow-up meeting as well. Senator Giesel, you had a question?
I do, and it may be a question for the Department of Revenue. Could you refresh my mind? Are there tax credits available for exploration and production of geothermal energy?
Uh, through the chair, Senator Geisel, I'm not familiar with that, and given the silence on the phone, I think we will probably have to respond to that question.
Senator Geisel?
Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask is, of course, we get ourselves into a revenue dilemma with tax credits, and I just want to make sure that we don't have random exploration tax credit applications out there for geothermal energy. So that's why I was asking the question. Probably the Department of Revenue is a better source.
Well, we would also like that information at the next meeting, please. I remember when this excitement was going on a few years back on the west side of Cook Inlet, and some of those, I believe there was a program. I don't know if it's sunsetted or not, but it would be nice to have that information at hand. Other questions? Senator Keel? Mr.
Chairman, in the category of not putting the presenters on the spot, I tried to go through the changes in the definition of geothermal resources, and I couldn't quite track what we were changing and why. So unless somebody's got that on the top of their brain, maybe follow up after the fact on what we're redefining would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I assume the folks on the phone and Ms. Ogan understand that question and can present that as well. The questions we've asked today, you can either put a letter together for us and then cover it at the next meeting, or just cover it at the next meeting. But I think those are questions that we'd all like to know before we move forward with this bill. Know the answer to. Other questions? Okay, two very interesting bills. I want to thank everyone for being here today. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday. We're going to put this bill aside. We'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 161 at the next meeting. We're going to put this bill aside, meet on Wednesday, where we'll have a presentation by the Department of Law on the various resource-related cases that they've been engaged in, and we will take up HB 122 once again. I want to thank our LIO moderator, Brett Collins, and Chris Stickrell with State Records, and my staff, Conrad Jackson, for their work today. And with there not being any further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:33 p.m.